Okay. So we saw in verse 17 there that God is leading the people out. I think that's a key word there, that he's leading them, right? We're going to see specifically more how he will lead them in verses 21 and 22, where he gives them these visible signs of his presence with them. But it says that he led them. And I think that's significant because all along the way in the wilderness and beyond, God will lead the people, right? Yes, he did select Moses and human leaders, but ultimately it's God who's leading them. And he leads them not by the way of the Philistines. I think that's significant. And I want to show you a map here. Hopefully you can kind of see that. Where the way of the Philistines would be going up around the Mediterranean Sea there, up into Israel. And he said he did not lead them that way because of war. And so he wanted to keep them from that. They do eventually fight with the Amalekites, but not with the Philistines. And so he is in some ways measuring the difficulty that he's leading them into right away, right? He's measuring it carefully, gauging what difficulties would be too great for them and caring for them in that way. So he leads them a different way. Although the way he's leading them is specifically going to put them in extra danger that he will deliver them from. So he leads them down into... And this, there's different ways to think about how he does this, and I am not an expert in geography. But I think the most likely way that he led them would have been down into the Sinai Peninsula, where then where they are hemmed in, right? And that's gonna, they're going to talk about that in chapter 14, that he's going to be they're going to be shut in, right? Where they're literally between the Red Sea and the mountains and cannot escape, which. Pharaoh is going to take advantage of, and then they're going to pass into Midian, which makes sense where Mount Sinai would be. That's where he was. Moses was pasturing the flock when he came to that mountain that they were coming back to, as a sign that God had led them. Right, that God had spoken to Moses. So anyway, that's just a precursor to what we're going to be seeing, but. That first part, that he's not leading them up through the Philistia, is what we see here. And he will constantly be with them. In fact, in verse 21 and 22, it says he went with them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night. The pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night did not depart from before the people. So God is leading them out in this first stage of the journey, day and night. He's not leaving them alone at all, not even for a moment, right? And he's giving them these visible signs that he is with them all the time, right? He doesn't depart from them even for a moment. And I think that's significant. One, they need to travel by day and by night because they're in a hurry, right? They have to go. This is not going to be an easy journey because they're continually traveling, but also they have that confidence that the Lord is with them. It reminds me of like Psalm 121:4, behold, he who watches over Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. Right? Literally, he's staying up with them all night and all day to watch them and take care of them and lead them. Any thoughts there on 17 through 22?
Yes. Psalm 99, verse 6 says that God spoke to them in the pillar of the cloud.
Yes, good. All right, let's jump into chapter 14. Can we switch over to that? We'll read the first, I think it's the first five verses. Let me pull that up. The first four verses of chapter 14. John Gates, you want to read that? 14, 1 to 4.
Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, tell the sons of Israel to turn back to the camp before Ahah-Harah, between Migdol and the sea. And you shall camp in front of the Baal Zephon, opposite it, by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the sons of Israel, they are wandering aimlessly in the land. The wilderness and shut them in. Thus I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will chase after them. And I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army. And the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord. And they did so.
Very good. Okay, so they go down into kind of that hemmed in place, right? And verse 3, it says the desert has closed them in, or the wilderness has closed them in. So God is leading them directly into a place where they would really be trapped in a way, right there where the Red Sea makes a V. But God knows what he's doing. Obviously, that would have seemed like a crazy tactic if it weren't for God. He knows that his people will doubt. He knows what Pharaoh will think, them going that way, and what it will tempt him to do to pursue the people, and also his plan to destroy Pharaoh and his army through this. And so God, he knows where the people are going, but he doesn't know that God is also leading Pharaoh himself into a trap. And Pharaoh doesn't have a good memory, right? He decided to pursue the people who had just ravaged his country, you know, whose God had just ravaged his country. And he forgot about the great power of the God who is of the Israelites and is pursuing them now, counting on the fact that he's figured out a way to get them, whereas it's God who's working through this to get Pharaoh. And he says in verse 4, I will be glorified through Pharaoh, right? This has been his plan from the beginning, that he will glorify himself. And the second part there, the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord, right? Remember back in 7:5, he had said that in the plagues, that a part of this also is that the Egyptians are going in. His glory and his name, again, are the goal of all of this. And we're going to talk about that more at the end, this idea of the Egyptians knowing who he is. We saw already that some of them were joining Israel and coming out. They had found favor in the eyes of the Egyptians. But ultimately, we're going to find as well that the Egyptians are going to be also a challenge for the Israelites. Let's read 5 through 14. Jason, you want to read that?
When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of Pharaoh and his servants was changed toward the people. And they said, what is this we have done, that we have let Israel go from serving us? So he made ready his chariot, took his army with him, took 600 chosen chariots of all the other chariots of Egypt, with officers over all of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the people of Israel, while the people of Israel were going out defiantly. The Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots, and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them, and camped at the sea by Harar, in front of Baal Zephon. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them. And they feared greatly, and the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. And Moses said to the people, fear not, stand firm, and see the salvation of the Lord which he worked for you. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent.
Very good. So in verse 5 there, Pharaoh says, what is this that we have done, that we have let Israel go? I think that's interesting that he would say that, right? Because clearly it was not, it was Pharaoh, it was God who had hardened Pharaoh's heart until he broke it, right? And God was the one who had led his people out, right? It was not Pharaoh gives himself too much credit, right, to think that he allowed the people to go, right? God was the one who brought them out. And Pharaoh still thinks he has more control than he has, right? Thinking that he can hem them in the wilderness and various other things. And again, verse 8, notice where he many times in this chapter will speak of God, again, hardening his heart because he's not done yet. God's not done with what he's going to do with Pharaoh and the Egyptians. Verse 4 had said that. Verse 8 and then also verse 17 says that he's continuing to harden Pharaoh's heart until the bitter end of Pharaoh and the Egyptians. Now, as Pharaoh is pursuing them, right, they the people begin to doubt. They begin to forget the things that the Lord has done. We see some of the first of the murmurings. I would say maybe the first of the murmurings would be when their plan initially goes wrong and they have to collect the straw as well as make the bricks and not reduce the quota. That was their first of their murmurings. But this is definitely along that line. And notice what they say. I think this is interesting. They say, leave us alone so that, or that. What does it say there in verse 12? They say, is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. They never said that, right? Nor would they have ever said that. They never wanted to stay in Egypt. In fact, they had groaned under their bondage and cried out for deliverance, right? For help because of the bondage, and that went up before God. And I think it's interesting here how they really, and this can happen to us as well, right? We're in the heat of the moment, when emotions are high, when we're overwhelmed, we reinterpret the past really to fit our present crisis. And we need to acknowledge that is a tendency that we can have, right? And seek to be led by principles and not by our impulses. JD?
Yeah, it's kind of a good parable here. You really have two people changing their mind. Pharaoh looked repentant, but wait, no, actually, I want him back. The people seem like they want to be out when things get scary. They want to go back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good lesson for us when we may be like confronted with sin, confronted with something bad, and so we do make a good decision or two, but it's still really easy to go back and, well, actually, I still want this sin, or I want this bad thing. We see just that over and over again, so we've got to be really diligent to have fair fruit in keeping with our repentance.
Yes, amen. Ramona, you were going to say something?
When he talks about how they encountered Moses first point to them in Pharaoh, they didn't get their own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They had them enough.
Mm-hmm.
I could see them maybe coming at that time. Just leave us alone, you know, maybe
mm-hmm.
So maybe they did say that.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, there in 5:21 they had said, you have made us odious in the sight of Pharaoh and his officials, putting a sword in their hands to kill us. Their doubt is similar here in that they say they're going to kill us in the desert, right? Yeah, but maybe you're right. Yeah, John.
Even more generically, if you ever make a decision, you're being emotional.
Mm-hmm.
Count to 10, take a breath.
Right.
Call. Think to stay through.
Mm-hmm.
We all must be careful about what we say. And our emotions are in control of our being.
Right.
And so let's think this thing through. In both cases, in Pharaoh's case, and in the case of the House of Israel, don't ever make a decision. Don't be reacting emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
Christ went to the cross because people were acting emotionally.
Right. Yes. Good point. Yeah, our emotions were given to us by God, but they need to be ruled by the truth, right? By our will. Yeah.
What do you think of verse 10 at the end where it says the people were, it says they're terrified and then they cried out to the Lord for help? Do you think there was some group among them who still said, Lord, save us, instead of complaining?
Maybe so, yeah. Yeah, certainly we see that later where there's a division in those who trusted in the Lord and those who didn't, right? With the spies, for example.
Later.
Yeah.
So, you said, well, they never said that in Egypt. I'm not so sure. I bet they did say that in Egypt, and it was at the time where Moses was working to deliver them, and Pharaoh got mad and made it harder on them. You know, we just want Moses. We'll just serve Pharaoh. And to me, that reminds me of, you know, our own lives when we're kind of stuck in that rut, stuck in sin, and it's almost like, well, it'd be easier for me to just finish my life stuck in sin than to do the hard work or accept the deliverance that really would benefit me. And that's kind of the attitude that they're showing here.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to see later, they're going to say, well, let's go ahead and pack up and go home, go back to Egypt and try to return to slavery because that was better than what God had done for them. But I don't think this attitude is that uncommon even amongst ourselves if we look at ourselves honestly. We're, yeah, it's not easy, but we need to get away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And God, the deliverance is going to give us the great outcome we deeply desire.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that maybe they actually had said it. And then I think the lesson is kind of like John 5, maybe, where Jesus says, do you want to be healed? You know, like where we get so comfortable in, and I wouldn't say they were comfortable, but we get so in a rut, like you said, in our sin, in our enslavement, that we just don't think that it's possible to get out, right? Things got worse when we tried, so I'm not going to try again. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're just getting started on this journey, and it always amazed me when I read through this how oftentimes the Israelites will do this. I mean, they'll just, you know, almost fight against God. But yet, we just talked about his presence. He's got a physical presence that they can see. It's not like, you know, a lot of times, yes, I would love to have more visual confidence in my faith, but yet they can look up and see this pillar. So every time, we have to remember this, every time that they rebel against God, or they murmur, God still has a physical presence there that they can see day and night in their camp. So it's not like they don't have any, you know, God's far from them. No, his presence is visible right there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, it always gets, it's kind of like reading through Judges, you get so aggravated that you almost wouldn't want to read it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I think that's interesting that you could, like, if we thought that our big hang-up in our faith was we don't actually see it with our eyes, we'd be wrong, right? Because even when they saw God with their eyes, you know, or they saw a visible presence of God with their eyes, they still had trouble with their faith, right? So it goes deeper than just what we can see. Yeah. So this attitude that they had at the Red Sea comes up in Psalm 106. And I wanted to read that. I want to see if I have that up here. Oh, yeah. Maybe did they disconnect us now? Okay. Okay. No problem. So in Psalm 106, verse 7 and 8, it says, "Our fathers, when they were in Egypt, did not consider your wondrous works. They did not remember the abundance of your steadfast love, but rebelled by the sea at the Red Sea. Yet," spoiler alert, "he saved them for his name's sake, that he might make known his mighty power." So I think you see really two amazing things there. Two things there. One is that God calls this attitude of having seen his wondrous works and not considering them an act of rebellion in this case, right? They should have put their trust in a God. That's what he expected. Even though, yes, it would have been scary, right? But even so, even with the bad attitude that they had, yet God still saved them. I think that's incredible as well. You see the great mercy of God in that. Both of those points. Thoughts? I thought I saw a hand, sorry. Okay. So verse 13, Pharaoh's pursuing Israel. He would have, of course, used the finest chariots they had while Israel is just fleeing on foot. It looks like Egypt would have had the upper hand here, militarily, right? They have the modern military advantage against Israel. And probably thought that, therefore, Israel will be defeated. But Moses says, do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance of the Lord that he will bring you today. The people's job in this case was simply to be still, right? Simply to be silent, to trust the Lord, and know that God will save them. And I think that's amazing. It's an amazing thought, is that sometimes we think that it depends too much on us, right? Sometimes we think that whether it's our salvation or whatever it may be, the thing that we are appealing to God for, we think it depends too much on us, when God may want us just to trust him and say, I know you can do this, and I'm going to leave it in your hands, right? There is a great peace that comes. In fact, that's what Philippians 4 teaches us, right? There's a great peace that comes when you hand it over to God, right? And he says, cast your cares upon me because I care for you, right? And I think that's it's a peace that we wouldn't have thought possible, he says. It's a peace that surpasses knowledge, that will guard your heart. And I think that's exactly what he's telling them to do here, is say, cast it upon me, entrust me with it, and you'll have this peace that clearly at this moment they did not have, right? And that will lead to then this lack of complaining. I think those are maybe the two points I would say from this, is trusting the Lord, and then not will lead to us not complaining, right? In fact, how it describes that we come to God there in Philippians is with thanksgiving, right? Remembering his wondrous works. They did not consider his wondrous works, Psalm 106 says. And one more thing real quick on that is that in our lack of complaining and our choosing to trust God in a moment, we will ultimately be lights in that to the world. I've often thought about, how is it that I be a light to the world, like my workplace or in the community or things like that? And I thought, well, would it be by my work ethic, like I work harder than everybody else? And I think I've come to realize that that is definitely not going to be the way. Reason being is because people work really hard out there because they want to make money, people want to move up the ladder, whatever. There are workaholics all over the place. And I'm not going to be working harder than them, I'm going to tell you that. And so I don't think that's always the way that we're going to ultimately show that we're different, right? Or shine as lights in the world. But here is a very clear way, he says, that we will shine as lights in the world, and that is do everything without grumbling or complaining, so that you may become blameless and pure, children of God without fault in a warped and crooked generation, where you will shine among them like stars in the sky. And that idea that our attitude being different about things will make a big difference. That is also, while workaholics are all over the place, also complainers, right, are all over the place. And that, if you don't do that, you will stand out, right, big time. Okay, what are your thoughts there through 14? Yes, Kim.
It reminds me of Psalm 46:10, says, be still and know that I am God. In order to trust God, I need to know who he is. It's hard to trust somebody you don't know. So, and I think he's proven to us, I think I know he's proven to us through his word, not just through his word, but his actions, that he is somebody that we can trust. And we should be.
Amen. Yes. Very good point.
As I think this through a little bit, there are moments where the children of Israel thought they were going out from the wilderness. They were going to be made a path. And in the fairness to them, you're gone. Here comes Pharaoh again. I think about the time I learned how to use a catcher's mask.
Mm-hmm.
I knew it was going to protect my face, but I still flinch when the ball comes at me. And I wonder if the house of Israel is still faithful. Is there still some more we got to go through here as Pharaoh comes chasing after us? So if they still need this reassurance from Moses and from God, saying, okay, we're still going to protect you. We're still going to get out of here. He's coming. So there's, bear with us.
Right. Yeah. They are very young in learning about the Lord. That is true. Yeah. Very good. Yes.
Right. Along the lines of the comments about their lack of faith, they've seen these tremendous miracles, right? And God has delivered them over and over. It's kind of hard to understand, I think, for us why they did that. And then by day, they have a pillar of some smoke, and then by night, the fire. I showed Bruce a picture last night of the Lord Loras, perfect column of light coming right there. It just makes you think of it. You see this, and it lit up the whole countryside. And that's nothing, I'm sure, compared to the light that they saw. You can't escape that God was there with them, and yet they still doubt it. And it reminded me of Jesus talking to the Pharisees and Sadducees, and them asking for a sign. And he said, no sign is going to be given to you except the sign of Jonah, Jesus raising from the dead, because they weren't going to believe. And you know, the signs given in the New Testament were given to build faith. But if you have people stubborn, not willing to listen or follow God, the sign can be given.
Yeah, amen. Good points. Yeah, right.
I think it's interesting that what's so special about God being physically with them. Of course, we think of that, we've never seen God in our lives, so for us it's like, whoa. But in a way, we have God with us at all times too, both in us being in the Spirit, as part of His kingdom, but also, I mean, the thing that would have been unique about God being with them in that era was they could talk to Him. They had direct communication with Him. They could ask Him things through Moses, and He could deliver His judgment and commands to them directly. And realistically, we have that same thing. We have His Word right here in the Bible with us. So we have a very similar line of communication.
Yeah, good points. Very good. Let's go to 15 through 20. And Brian Hunt, you want to read that?
Then the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? The sons of Israel to go forward. For as you lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divided, and the sons of Israel shall go through the midst of the sea on dry land. As for me, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, so they will go in after them, and I will be honored through Pharaoh and his army, through his chariots and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord, that I am honored through Pharaoh, through his chariots and his horsemen. The angel of God, who had been going there long before the camp of Israel, moved and went before them, and the pillar of cloud moved before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of Egypt and the camp of Israel, and there was a cloud along the darkness, and yet it gave light at night. Thus the one did not come near the other all night.
Very good. So the Lord says to Moses, why do you cry out to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward. And so I think it's interesting that that God addresses Moses here, even though it's the voice of the people that had been crying out to him. And it's like, you know, Moses is both representing them before God and also representing God to them, right? That's the intercessor idea, which Jesus is for us. And he tells them, God tells them to move on, right? To go forward. And it's like if your kid is entrapped in things and they look up at you and like, where do I go? And you're like, just go forward. And it's like, well, where? You know, they're hemmed in the wilderness, right? And go forward where? Right? Where are they going to go? There's this large sea right in front of them, the mountains behind them, and so they don't have anywhere to go. But of course, what God does is He parts the sea. He shows His control once again over His creation, the winds and the sea, just like we see later with Jesus being able to do that. And now God doesn't just harden Pharaoh's heart, but also all the Egyptians that are pursuing their hearts as well. Their hearts become as hard as Pharaoh's. And this is how, verse 18, the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I am glorified through Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. Again, that repetition of God showing his great power through this, his great might, and glorifying himself. God's not finished with what he's doing here. And verse 19 says that the angel of God, who was going before the host of Israel, moved and went behind them. So I think that's interesting as well, that the presence with them, similar to the burning bush, right, is the angel of God. It's his representative in that sense. And he moves and goes in between them to protect his people with the cloud in between them and the Egyptians. And again, you have this visual representation of God's protection of them in that case. Him leading them, but then also his protection of them. What are your thoughts there through verse 20? Mm-hmm. Sure. I've also asked that question as well, yeah. And that was my guess as well, that Pharaoh did go in, yeah. Right, right. Yes, Kim.
I really like that's the key to suffering and trials and tribulations. It's just knowing who God is.
Mm-hmm.
Some people say that Job, you never got answered when he was suffering. But I believe he did. God reminded him.
Mm-hmm.
That he was in control, and right. That he needed to trust him. And throughout the Bible, that's what he keeps doing to his people. He's constantly reminding them who he is, and not just them, but the Egyptians, people around them. And it's good for us to know who he is.
Yes.
It's for our own good to know who he is. It's going to get us through trials and tribulations, and then also when we're praying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very good point. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, him leading them in this place where they're trapped, right? Very clearly, he wants to teach them a lesson. Like the parables aren't over, right? About who God is, even though the plagues are over, God is still working in very specific ways to teach them about what he can do. I think that's a very key. Thank you. Other thoughts there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there in verse 20, is that what you're saying? And there was a cloud and the darkness, and it lit up the night without one coming near the other all night. That sounds like, to me, which reminds us, what were we going to say about that? Right. That's how I take it, that it was at night, so naturally it would be dark, but then he lit up the Israelite side. And that reminds us of the darkness plague, right? Where half of it was, or that he again shows a division between his people and the Egyptians, yeah. Yeah, good point. Yes?
Yeah, I think it was kind of the point of it is that the Lord went to stand between the enemy,
mm-hmm.
where the people were rescued. And
right, yes.
Protecting his people, they just changed from front to back.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yes. So let's read 21 to 25. And Terry, you want to read that?
Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord swept the sea back by a strong east wind all night, and turned the sea into dry land, so the waters were divided. And the sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on the dry land, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Then the Egyptians took up the pursuit, and all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots and his horsemen, went in after them into the midst of the sea. And it came about, the morning watch, that the Lord looked down on the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and brought the army of the Egyptians into confusion. And he caused their chariot wheels to swerve, and made them drive with difficulty. So the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from Israel, for the Lord is fighting for them against the Egyptians."
Very good. So we see that the Israels, or sorry, God, of course, makes a way, right? He, when they were trapped, when they were completely enclosed, and it looked like there was no other way, God makes a way, right? He made an completely unexpected way for them. And I think that's incredible that God can do that at any moment, right? God, or you may be in a situation in which you think there's no way out of this, and there always is a way out of it, right? Because you have God working in your life. And I think that's really powerful. When they go through the sea, it's interesting because you see some New Testament interpretation of that, where Paul, through the Holy Spirit, interprets that as them being baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea in 1 Corinthians 10. And God's using water, you know, to save them. So I think that's a cool parallel there. And of course, I haven't talked about this much yet, but we have really this parallel between Israel and Jesus as well. Matthew really highlights that, that I thought I'd mention just briefly, that I already mentioned Hosea 11:1, right, that God called his son up out of Egypt, which is, of course, exactly what happened with Jesus. They were in Egypt, fleeing from Herod, but then came up out of Egypt. And then Jesus is beginning his ministry. He is baptized, just as Israel, in this sense, is baptized in the sea, as 1 Corinthians 10 says. And then Jesus spends 40 days in the wilderness being tested and tempted and he hungers, and tempted toward idolatry, right? Tempted toward unbelief. Same thing for what we're going to see with the Israelites, is that they were 40 years in the wilderness with these same temptations and these same challenges. Yet Jesus is victorious where the Israelites fail. And then ultimately, Israel comes to Mount Sinai, where they're given the law. Jesus, many see the parallel there with Jesus then on the mount, giving the law of the kingdom, right, and the Sermon on the Mount. So you have a very, very intentional parallels there with Jesus following the path that Israel did, but in a greater way. So I thought I'd mention that. So the Egyptians pursue them, and I think this is interesting because in that moment, maybe you thought when they were hemmed in that, as an Egyptian, right, that you could catch them, like their God failed in some way, right? But when their God opens up the sea so they can escape, like wouldn't you at that moment realize, okay, we should not go in here? But I think that's the nature of the hard heart, right? That's the nature of being enslaved, right? And that God's reversed it, right? Now the Israelites are free, but it's the Egyptians who are enslaved, right? They're the ones who are enslaved to their own desires and passions and blinded through that, really. The truth, which would have been obvious and right before their eyes, they did not recognize it. They did not see it because in their hard hearts they were enslaved to their passions. And so they go in after it, right? They go in after the Israelites, and that becomes their downfall. Even their advanced technology specifically did not help them, right? Because God clogged their wheels. And God showed, again, that he will be glorified, right? Even the greatest army in the world, right, coming against his people will not prevail. What are your thoughts there through verse 25? Yeah.
This is truly the Cecil B. DeMille episode, right? When you see Moses and all this, this is not there's a lot of people and speculators and commentators trying to say, well, the wind just pushed down the shallow grassy area and pushed the water away. And no, this is walls of water. You know, this is no natural phenomenon, right? And it actually says the wind is wind from the east, right? And if you look at the actual layout, the wind would have to be from the north to do what some of these other people would say. God did exactly what he said, right? Mm-hmm. Part of the water. And people walk through. Now you talk about why would the Egyptians follow through? You know, hardened of their hearts, maybe, certainly, right? But also, you got to remember, they remember that Pharaoh is the highest God on earth. And they're listening to that and saying, maybe our God or the great Egypt will overcome this.
But, yeah.
Obviously, they were wrong.
Right. Yeah, good point.
Mm-hmm. I think the Egyptians here still feel like they can grab a little bit of control of the situation. I mean, every time they try that, God shows them that, no, he's in control. And here, as they go in after them, say, okay, if they can go across this on dry land, we can too. Well, their chariots begin to swerve. And the Egyptians know, we are not in control, but it's too late because you know what happens next.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So. Two things are in my mind. First of all, the first great judgment on earth, God's children, Noah's family, are saved by water.
Mm-hmm.
And the world is destroyed by water.
Mm-hmm.
Here we have God's children saved by water, and the enemy is destroyed by water.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first great judgment.
Right.
The other thing is, I can't imagine what the charioteers must have been thinking about as they pursued this. I think some of the confusion is like, what are we doing? As they look at one another and they see these walls of water, and they think, wait a minute, their God is in control of the situation now.
Mm-hmm.
And they think, I think that's what happens.
Mm-hmm.
It creates confusion.
Oh, okay. Huh. You may be right. Yes, Bruce. I
heard one preacher say, were they saved before they went through the water or after they went through the water?
Oh.
Yeah.
Very good. All right. We'll finish up the end of 14 and get into 15 next time. Thank you all.